This is Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Jeremy Hobson along with Sasha Pfeiffer. And we got two court rulings today about the Affordable Care Act. The first was a ruling from the Federal Appeals Court in the District of Columbia Circuit, which has the potential to derail billions of dollars in subsidies for people who bought health insurance through the federal health care exchanges. People in 36 states could be affected, and these are states that opted not to set up their own exchanges. Moments after that ruling, a federal appeals court in Virginia came to the opposite conclusion. So what does all this mean? Well, joining us now is Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington correspondent, and Julie Rovner of Kaiser Health News. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks.
Good to be with you.
Well, Ron, let's start with the ruling from the D.C. Circuit Court. What did they say?
The court looked at one particular section of the Affordable Care Act, Section 1311, and said, close reading, or really a straight reading of that section, says that these tax subsidies, tax credits and other forms of subsidies administered by the IRS are only available through the states, only where a state has set up one of these exchanges, and not for a federal exchange. And as you say, 36 states are operating with a federal exchange, and the IRS is administering it. And this court said, that's just not right. That's not the way 1311 reads. And so they struck it down, and that would have enormous ramifications for the entire structure of Obamacare.
And then we got a ruling from a court in Virginia. What did that say?
Basically the opposite. It said the IRS is due deference in this case, because if you go down just a little further in the law to sections 1311, just a little bit, just a couple pages further along, you're going to find a section that says that where the states do not set up their own exchange, the federal government can set up such exchanges and essentially do whatever the state exchanges might have been able to do through the IRS. And that is essentially the way the law has been operating. And by a unanimous opinion in this court in Richmond, 3-0, they ruled that they were fine with that and that there shouldn't be a problem.
Is that pure coincidence that we got two rulings so close to each other like that?
No, these cases have been proceeding on parallel tracks for a little while since the plaintiffs first thought they had discovered a flaw that could interfere with the administration of the law. And indeed, if upheld ultimately by whatever the highest court that deals with this might be, perhaps the U.S. Supreme Court, then it certainly would interfere big time with the administration of this law. They've been proceeding along the last several months and were both decided in district courts earlier this year. To the same effect, both of the district courts throughout this challenge.
All right, Julie Rovner, you know this healthcare law better than anyone. Tell us what this all means for Obamacare.
Well, immediately, not anything. I think people shouldn't really start to panic, particularly who have gotten these subsidies, thinking they're going to lose them right away. Right now, the Justice Department has already said that it's going to appeal the D.C. Appeals Court ruling to the full Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, which is actually dominated by Democratic appointees. So there's the expectation that actually this decision overturning the subsidies in the federal exchange would go away almost immediately. Obviously, though, we're looking at there are a couple of more cases around the country arguing the same thing. So we're looking at some prolonged litigation, I suspect.
But what if this were to – what if the D.C. Appeals Court decision were to stand? What then for the healthcare law?
It would be you know, momentous. The judges, even the judges who ruled for it, agreed that this is, you know, an attempt to basically undo the law. According to the consulting firm Avalere Health, in the 36 states served by the federal exchange, 87% of people who bought coverage got premium subsidies. If those subsidies went away, most of those people would no longer be required to have insurance because their insurance would be unaffordable. And remember, you're not required to have insurance if it's unaffordable. If those people ended up not buying it, they couldn't afford it, don't have insurance, the insurance requirements that insurance companies take everybody who applies, regardless of whether they're sick or healthy, and they have to give everybody coverage, the whole insurance sort of structure in those states could really collapse. And that would, you know, clearly it's an untenable situation for the ongoing law.
Ron, would the result in any state be that the state's governor, who had previously decided that they didn't want to set up their own exchange, would then decide that they, okay, fine, we'll set up an exchange?
In theory, yes. And there were a couple of states that just had a lot of trouble doing it. It wasn't that they were necessarily that philosophically opposed to doing it. But most of these states are red states. There are states where there was a great deal of opposition to the law. And it's not likely that, say, Scott Walker in Wisconsin would step away from the program he's put in place of this. It's not likely that somebody in a state that had really rejected the Obamacare approach would want to suddenly embrace it. So I think we can safely assume that what the courts decide with respect to this will determine the preponderance of situations across the country.
And what's the Obama administration saying today?
Well, first thing they said was that they will appeal the D.C. Circuit Court, which was the adverse ruling. That one they are going to appeal to the full court, en banc, they call it, the entire bank of all the judges. And they would expect to prevail there. But then the next thing that could happen is that the losers in Richmond, the people in the Fourth Circuit Court, could go directly to the Supreme Court, could ask the Supreme Court to take that case. And that would give the Supremes a shot at it if they wish to take it.
All right. Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington correspondent, and Julie Rovner of Kaiser Health News with today's two big court rulings, the latest from a couple of different circuits. Guys, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we want to update you on another story also from a court. Yesterday, we brought you the story of two men from Key West hoping to get a marriage license today. A judge had ruled in favor of Aaron Huntsman and William Lee Jones, who argued that Florida's ban on same-sex marriage violated their rights under the U.S. Constitution. But the same judge yesterday decided in favor of the Florida Attorney General, who had appealed that ruling, which means for now, Monroe County, Florida, will not issue marriage licenses to gay couples, and the case now heads to an appellate court.
Today, a train carrying the bodies of many of those who died when Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 was shot down in eastern Ukraine arrived in the Ukrainian government-held city of Kharkiv. The remains will now be taken to the Netherlands for identification, possibly as early as tomorrow. Pro-Russian separatists who control the region where the plane went down have also handed over the plane's black boxes to Malaysian officials. But 5 days after the accident, the crash site still has not been secured. Philip Warwick is a freelance photojournalist, and he joins us from the site where the plane went down. Philip, what is the scene like there today?
When we arrived today, basically there weren't any armed separatists. The emergency services haven't been here for the last 2 days. One thing that struck me when I arrived here yesterday morning is that they had a crane here, a Soviet-type crane, and they started to lift the larger parts of the fuselage, the cabin, and I think also the undercarriage. When I actually approached one of the emergency service members to ask him what exactly they were doing, he said that they were looking for bodies. But I have to say that as they lifted the, certain segments, they didn't actually replace them in their proper place. So they would lift it up, say, maybe a meter and a half, 2 meters, and then place it down, I would say, maybe 2-3 meters away from the original placement. So based on that observation, I would also say that every day that I've been here for the last 6 days, items have been moved, plane parts have been moved, one way or the other. And what I would like to say is that this probably would give the investigators who plan to come a different picture altogether with regard to how the plane crash, when it all actually happened in terms of where the parts were. It's a completely different picture now altogether. So when they do carry out the investigation, it will be interesting to find out or to see if they realize that certain parts or certain, say, areas maybe don't make sense or are strange, because these experts tend to have, say, inside knowledge or tend to have the know-how and instantly recognize if a plane has been struck or has crashed.
Philip, you're a freelance photojournalist, as we mentioned, and you have had access to the crash site. Is access limited for journalists?
Well, when the Dutch forensic team arrived, they made a point of actually cordoning off. There's a road which leads up to a particular village, and on both sides of the road were bodies and films and were personal items and plane parts. On that particular day, they made an effort to cordon it off to give the impression that the area was secured. And after that, when Dutch experts left, the scene is again open to the elements, open to anybody who wishes to come here. Actually, a few moments ago, it's difficult to say if they were locals or they've come here, they came here by taxi, they took a few pictures. They looked like curious locals or curious tourists who've come here to take a look at the crash site, and there's nothing here to stop them to walk all over the evidence, the crash site, or even help themselves to some of the personal belongings that are now scattered, because most of the personal belongings now were taken to the train station yesterday. What has happened to them, I don't know, but here I can see a life vest. I can see an oxygen mask. I can see a few seats. They're scattered in the field.
Philip, this crash site is still an active war zone. Are you seeing any kind of fighting near the scene or in and around Donetsk?
Well, the Ukrainian president, Petro Poroshenko, has instructed the army not to fight within a 25-mile radius of the site where the Malaysian Airlines was shot down. And this apparently has been observed by the Ukrainian army. But from the distance, you do actually hear rocket launches being launched and actually then landing at a fair distance, where the result is just a large plume of smoke rising up. So you hear, for example, even 3-4 minutes ago, I did hear again those rocket launches. They're called Grad, which in Russian means hail. Their range is between 5 to 40 kilometers, and they've been used by both sides. But you do hear in the distance, I've heard in the distance, say, within the last 15 minutes, two rounds of that particular missile launcher being used.
Philip, from the photojournalism work you've been doing at this site since you've been there, are there any pictures you've taken that really particularly stick with you?
Yes, absolutely, especially photographs, pictures taken of toys. I've come across Winnie the Pooh teddy bear or Winnie the Mouse lunchbox, Lego, even a My Little Bible book for children. And I think that is, each time I took a photograph, it was a very poignant moment for me, because these young children were planning about going on holiday, having a good time, enjoying their time with their families, and such a tragedy struck them.
Philip Warwick is a freelance photojournalist who's been reporting from the area in eastern Ukraine where Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 was shot down. Philip, thank you and be safe.
Thank you.
And one big piece of foreign news that has been overshadowed by the recent headlines out of Gaza and Ukraine is what's happening in Iran. It just agreed, along with the U.S., to extend negotiations over its nuclear program for 4 more months. That's after missing the July 20th deadline for a comprehensive agreement, one that would prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons, something the West fears that it wants to do. Of course, Iran has always maintained that its program is for energy and science, not weapons. Joining us now is Karim Sajjadpour, a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's with us from Washington. Karim Sajjadpour, welcome.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, there was an intense 16-day negotiation in Vienna to meet this deadline for an agreement. So why was there no deal, do you think?
Well, I think, Jeremy, when the interim deal was reached in November, there was a fundamental mismatch in expectations about what a comprehensive deal would entail. For the United States in particular, they believed that this was merely the first step. And in order to reach a comprehensive deal, Iran would need to curtail its nuclear program much further. Whereas Iran believed that the interim deal was merely a first step, and in subsequent steps, Iran would be able to retain what it now has of its nuclear program, and the United States would need to push back its sanctions regime much further. So there was this mismatch in expectations, but I think that both sides, and obviously we're talking not just about the United States and Iran, we're talking about the P5+1, which entails, in addition to the United States, the United Kingdom, France, Germany, Russia, and China. But really the primary mistrust is between Washington and Tehran. But I think both parties recognize that a continuation of the negotiations is better than any alternative option.
Why, for the United States, is that the case? Why is it better for a continuation of the negotiations if they're not getting what they want in terms of a curtailing of the nuclear program?
Well, I think from the standpoint of President Obama, he has two fundamental objectives vis-a-vis Iran. He wants to avert a nuclear armed Iran, and he wants to avert having to take military action against Iran. And a continuation of negotiations checks both those boxes for President Obama. And also, look at the world from President Obama's eyes. Everywhere he looks, there are crises, whether that's in Israel-Palestine now with the Gaza war, with Russia, in Syria and Iraq. Almost the entire Middle East is in flames. The last thing he wants is to create another conflict with Iran. And frankly, Iran provides President Obama one of the very few opportunities to try to leave a positive diplomatic legacy. And likewise, on the Iranian end, you have a new president in Iran, Hassan Rouhani, who has banked his entire presidency on reaching this nuclear deal. And from the standpoint of the Iranian people, they overwhelmingly want to see an arrangement whereby they emerge from economic and political isolation and the country's economic lot is improved.
So where exactly are they far apart on a deal? Why couldn't they reach an agreement?
At the moment, the biggest hurdle is the number of centrifuges which Iran should be allowed to spin. In the eyes of the United States, that number should be very low. We're talking about maybe a couple thousand, whereas Iran wants to retain what it has now, which is 10,000 centrifuges. But it also wants to expand to an industrial scale nuclear program within the next decade. Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, said that Iran's practical needs are well over 100,000 centrifuges. He said that very recently. And that's at least 10 times more than the U.S. government would be willing to countenance. So there are some other disputes as well, but that's been the fundamental hurdle up until now.
And what about sanctions? How are those sanctions going in Iran now? And have they, if they were to be ratcheted up, how much of an effect would that have in Iran? Because, of course, that was the promise that President Obama initially made, was that if they couldn't reach a deal, that there would be more sanctions.
That's a good question, Jeremy. Essentially, the administration likes to say that the broad sanctions architecture against Iran remains. And that was the case during the duration of the interim deal, meaning that Iran, what Iran received as a financial incentive wasn't really sanctions relief. It was that it was given some of its frozen assets abroad. And these are this is also the term of the extension, that Iran would be given a little less than $3 billion of its own frozen assets and foreign bank accounts as a financial incentive. But the sanctions are, you know, many believe that it was the onerous sanctions against Iran's central bank and the sanctions which slashed Iran's ability to produce and export oil, which brought it to the negotiating table. And I think there is some truth to that. But now, I imagine Iran kind of this like this elephant with a 10,000-pound load. And passing additional sanctions would only add a few hundred more pounds to that load. And so I think additional sanctions, in the event that we're not able to reach a comprehensive deal, won't be enough to force Iran to compromise. But I think it could be enough to escalate into a pretty dangerous position.
How popular is President Rouhani in Iran now, given the fact that they were not able to reach a deal? This is a person who came to power as a reformer and as probably you would say a more liberal Iranian than certainly the other alternatives.
Well, that's right. President Rouhani, he's been in office now 1 year. And as I mentioned, he's put all of his political capital into reaching this nuclear deal. He hasn't really made much of an effort to push for greater political freedoms, greater social freedoms. I think there's an implicit understanding with the Iranian public that his first, second, and third priority is reaching this nuclear deal. And if the nuclear deal is reached, that will bring a bounty of other things, which is, you know, improved economic situation, foreign investment, etc. And he hasn't succeeded in delivering that. But on the other hand, he is an improvement over his predecessor Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who, you know, as we remembered over an 8-year period during his time, the political social freedoms of Iranians were significantly curtailed, and the country was severely economically mismanaged. So I think Rouhani, in his first year in office, has been a slight improvement vis-a-vis Ahmadinejad. But on the other hand, he really hasn't fulfilled the huge expectations people have and had of him.
Finally, Karim, I just want to ask you, we only have about a minute left, but how does what's happening in Gaza look to from Iran's perspective?
It's a good question, Jeremy. Iran's reputation had taken a huge hit in the Middle East over the last few years, given its support for the Assad regime in Syria, which is massacring Sunni Arabs. And as we know, Iran is a Shiite Persian country in a predominantly Sunni Arab world. So Iran had lost tremendous soft power given its support for Assad and also given its support for the Maliki government in Iraq. But Iran is in its element when there's fighting between Israelis and Palestinians, and in particular when there's mass popular outrage in the region vis-a-vis Israel. So I think at the moment, Iran stands to gain at least from continued fighting in the Gaza war.
Karim Sajjadpour is a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Karim, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Anytime. Thank you, Jeremy.
It is a relatively modest deal for the tech industry, reportedly around $200 million, and it's kind of obscure, but it has the whole industry talking today. Yahoo is buying Flurry, which bills itself as a, quote, advertising exchange. To help us understand why this matters, we've got Peter Kafka here, senior editor at Recode. He's with us from New York. Peter, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So what is Flurry?
So Flurry started out as an app. Mobile analytic company. It would tell developers, other folks, what was happening on iPhones and other smartphones. More recently, it's become more of an advertising business itself. It's actually selling and helping people sell and buy ads on mobile phones.
And why does Yahoo want that so badly?
So Yahoo is either interested in the analytics part or the advertising part. They're both connected. But Yahoo is, like many web publishers, is trying to figure out how to build up a mobile web mobile advertising business. Yahoo is quite far behind, so they've spent a lot of time sort of buying very small companies, sort of a handful of developers at a time. Here, this is by far the largest deal they've made to date under a relatively new CEO, Marissa Mayer.
And when you say they're far behind, I assume that means they're far behind Google and Facebook and what, maybe Twitter?
Twitter, yeah. I mean, and by the way, a lot of folks like Facebook have been in this boat before. Facebook, when it went public just a few years ago, had zero mobile advertising revenue. It was a big problem for Wall Street. They seem to have quickly fixed that, at least temporarily. But Yahoo is sort of, when Mayer came on, looked around and said, boy, we are really far behind when it comes to mobile, and that's going to be a major priority for us.
You're talking about the Yahoo CEO, Marissa Mayer, who has actually signed a series of deals since taking over in 2012, including buying the blogging site Tumblr for more than $1 billion. What does this say about Yahoo's strategy?
Well, everyone's sort of waiting for Marissa Mayer besides the Tumblr deal. Everyone's waiting for her to make sort of big, giant, sort of tectonic shaking deals. She hasn't made one yet.
Like what would that be?
Hoping one will come. They want her to buy something like Pinterest or some other big flashy property and spend billions of dollars. At one point, she expressed some interest in Hulu. Maybe she'll buy Vivo, a big music video site. But in the meantime, you can see what she's really trying to do is say, look, we might be able to do big deals, but in the meantime, what we have to do is actually build up our mobile ad business. We're way behind. We have to fix that.
Take us back a step here, and let's just talk about the mobile ad business, because this is a part of the business that it doesn't seem that anyone has really gotten a handle on how to make money yet. And they're doing it to a greater degree, but they haven't really figured it out quite yet, how to make money on mobile ads, or have they?
No, I mean, people are making some money. They're not making – what happens in the digital world is everyone assumes that, well, if we're spending more time watching video, we're spending more time looking at websites, then obviously all the advertising money that used to get spent on magazines or TV will move over there. And it does, but it moves much more slowly than everyone expects, and that's what's happening on phones as well. We're spending a ton of time on our phones. We're checking it dozens, hundreds of times a day. But marketers aren't spending sort of a commensurate amount. That's the big sort of macro problem with phones. Phones also have specific problems. They're sort of hard to figure out how to build an advertisement that works on a relatively small screen, for starters. It's also hard to sort of figure out who's actually looking at the ad. On the web, they've gotten pretty sophisticated about saying, all right, we know that you visited this website, and now you're at Yahoo, and we're going to show you, we're going to target you based on your previous travels around the web. You can't do that on phones.
Well, and I'm sure that there are a lot of competitors to Flurry out there wishing they had been the ones who had been bought.
Some of them have been bought. Twitter bought a company earlier last year before they went public. Some of these things have been in the market for a while.
Peter Kafka, senior editor at Recode, talking about this big deal that Yahoo is going to buy Flurry. And you can read more about it at our website, hereandnow.org. Peter, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
It's that time of year when you'll soon be seeing tons of advertisements for back-to-school sales, and your mailbox may be getting jammed with clothes catalogs full of little boys and little girls dressed for their first big day back in the classroom. The National Retail Federation says a family with school-aged children will spend an average of $635 on clothes, shoes, and other wardrobe purchases. There are all sorts of ways people try to save money on clothing, comparing prices, using coupons and membership club discounts, shopping online, buying used. But there is one cost-cutting strategy that doesn't get a lot of attention, even though a lot of people are doing it. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, New Hampshire Public Radio's Taylor Quimby explains.
I've got a little confession to make. For about 3 years now, I've been wearing boys' underwear. Not toddler-sized briefs with Iron Man or Thomas the Tank Engine plastered on the butt. I'm talking about plainly colored, brand-name, boys, extra-large boxer briefs. Scoff if you have to, but if you saw me in my skivvies, I guarantee you would have no idea. Just ask my wife.
If I didn't tell you one of these was boys and one of these were men, and you didn't...
I would never know. I would never know if I had to guess.
For most brands, a pair of XL boys' undies have a waist size of 28 to 30, which is exactly the same as what I used to wear, a men's small. As far as I can tell, they are, design-wise, nearly identical. In fact, the only place I can feel or see a difference is my wallet.
You don't get, like, two more or one more?
Yeah, so the men's are $12.99, the boys are $9.99, and you get
How
one
more
pair.
Are you serious?
Yeah. I mean, you have to be a 28 to 30. But this is the gray zone where the waist is exactly the same.
For years, I was too embarrassed to share my cash-saving strategy with the rest of the world. But recently, I decided to come out of the proverbial changing room and see who else out there has been shopping in the kids section.
Whenever I'm looking for something that I think I could get, like this lovely rain jacket that I have on actually is a boys large because it was probably $50 less than the adult.
What brand is it?
It's North Face, I think. Yeah, North Face.
That's my friend Sarah Palermo, who at 4'11 occupies the same sort of retail gray zone as I do.
Pants because I'm super short.
That's another friend of mine, Aaron Stewart.
Also for socks and like pajamas, that kind of thing. For me, it's more pants just because of the height thing. And I'm just short in general, so shirts also tend to fit a little bit better and don't sag, and the sleeves aren't really long.
And that's not all. My sister-in-law buys kids' Red Sox and Patriots gear. My cousin Riley buys kids' shoes. Amy buys kids' winter gear. My mom wears kids' hats. All in all, more than a dozen people I know ponied up to buying kids' clothing of some kind or another. And yes, most of them are slim or petite, but not to the degree you might think. Ed Gribben has an explanation. He's president of Alvinon, a company that does research around how clothes fit and advises brands on sizing measurements.
Over the last approximately 30 years, brands and retailers have tended to increase the sizes of their clothing so dramatically that in women's wear, what used to be a size 8 in 1978 is today considered a size 0.
In other words, the average American is getting bigger, and retail brands are modifying their clothing lines to match. It's a trend the industry calls vanity sizing.
But they're not offering any more sizes. So the people who are at the smaller end of the size scale are somewhat disenfranchised. They can't find clothes that fit them. My daughter and my wife are two cases in point. They go out shopping and they both wear about a size 2 or a size 0. And many brands don't offer those sizes.
But like me, not everybody buys because they can't find adult options that fit. Bargain hunting can be a total thrill, and shoppers love the feeling that they know something other consumers don't.
I guess, do you get a feeling of, you know, satisfaction when you go up to the checkout counter?
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely a little rush, a little bit of glee knowing that you're kind of gaming the system a little bit. It makes up for having to use a stool to get stuff in the kitchen. It's one little victory for short people.
So I guess the question is, why not buy kid-sized clothes? To answer that, I want to go back to that conversation I had with my wife.
If I didn't tell you one of these was boys and one of these were men, and you didn't...
I would never know. I would never know if I had to guess.
Like, if you met me, though, and you were just, like, doing my laundry...
And I just looked at the label, and I was like, what the f***? Oh, sorry. Whoops.
There you have it. That's why not to buy kids' underwear. Here's neuropsychologist Dr. David Lewis.
So much of our shopping is done more or less on autopilot. So we kind of have a set routine of steps in our shopping program, and we follow them almost blindly.
Lewis explains that anything that interrupts our shopping autopilot can stop a potential sale in its tracks. A long line, a rude salesperson, even a tiny white tag stamped with the letter B instead of M.
You see this pair of pants, for example, and it's you think, oh, that's great, and it's a great price. And then you see, oh, it's labeled for boys. That would introduce a disrupt to your thinking. You then have to actually switch to your more conscious parts of your brain to actually say, well, do I actually want to wear something which is actually for kids when I'm no longer a kid?
For women, I suspect this isn't as big a disrupt as it is for men. Fitting into children's clothes may even be a point of pride for some who've recently lost weight or snagged a particularly good deal. Not so for guys. Owen Islin was once shopping with his daughter at a used kids' clothing store when he stumbled upon a pair of corduroys.
Went into the adjacent fitting room to my daughter's fitting room, and, I mean, coming out, there was definitely some looks. I think I was probably the first man ever to try anything on in that store.
Of the dozen or so people that came forward for the story, Owen was the only man to admit to buying kids' clothes. But when I got him on tape, I discovered that the pants in question weren't even technically for kids.
I wear a 33, 32.
They were just being sold at a used clothing store on a rack labeled young men. And he was still pretty clearly embarrassed about it.
I'm not sure I would try something on again in the same store, knowing the reaction I would probably get, you know. Sort of felt like I got caught doing something. I don't know.
My theory? Men feel too emasculated by the prospect of buying clothes for children. They'd rather pay more for the adult alternative. For me, making the leap wasn't easy, but when faced with that cognitive disrupt that Dr. Lewis just described, I found myself asking a question. Would I rather be thought of as a prudent shopper or someone willing to spend extra to feel more like a man? The irony, of course, is that I'm wearing boys' underwear right now, and nobody would ever know the difference if I didn't say so on the radio. For Here and Now, I'm Taylor Quimby.
Do I have to say what I think it is right now?
Well, I just wanted to know if you had a guess.
No, I don't want to guess yet. I think they look good on you. That's not part of it, though, right?
And now to Texas, where Governor Rick Perry is beefing up the state's security presence at its southern border with Mexico. Perry has decided to send up to 1,000 National Guard troops to the Rio Grande Valley over the next month. He says the deployment will bolster the state's existing operation against criminal activity amid an influx of children and families entering the U.S. illegally in the region.
Drug cartels, human traffickers, individual criminals are exploiting this tragedy for their own criminal opportunities. Over the years, I have repeatedly called on the federal government to live up to its responsibility of protecting this great nation by securing the border.
Perry says the federal efforts have failed, so now he is stepping up. For details, we turn to Ben Philpott in Austin, Texas. He's a senior reporter who covers state politics and policy at KUT. And Ben, there have been National Guard troops along the border for years, but this deployment will add more. Exactly what will these new troops be doing?
It looks like they're going to be helping to support an initiative that the governor announced about a month ago, which increased the number of Department of Public Safety or state trooper people within the border area. So they're going to be there as a show of force, he said in that press conference yesterday, essentially just providing that backup to the people that were already in place as part of this other initiative.
Now, Texas state and local law enforcement cannot enforce federal immigration law. So will these guard troops be allowed to, for example, detain people?
The adjunct general here in Texas yesterday did say that they will be able to detain people. And also, Governor Perry made the point in the press conference over and over that these people are not being sent there as part of the to collect, unaccompanied minors that are coming across the border. This is instead because the Border Patrol is having to deal with the unaccompanied minors, that they're being placed down there to go after drug cartels and any illegal activity beyond that might be slipping through.
Do you have a sense, Ben, of whether 1,000 additional troops is a substantial amount, or is this more of a symbolic move?
Well, the Texas border is gigantic, and so I think 1,000 is a symbolic move. But you know, Republicans would say that it's a move that at least they're doing something, unlike they say the federal government, which is doing nothing in their estimation.
And what does the White House say about this?
Well, you know, the president had a had a plan about a month ago to try and add some additional people and increase the immigration processing program and try to deal with this in some way. That, of course, has gone nowhere in Congress. So, you know, they're saying, well, we're trying to do something, but we're being blocked at it.
Now, the cost of this is, of course, a big issue. The total cost of the plan Perry already had in place, with you, which you mentioned, plus the additional Guard troops, estimated at more than $17 million a month. Who will foot the bill for that?
Well, Texas will right now, although Republican lawmakers have been for several years sending bills back to the federal government saying, please pay us. They have not received any payment yet, but once again, they say they're going to try and ask for payment. And the attorney general here in Texas, who's also running for governor, says that he's ready to take legal action, take the government to court if they don't pay for it.
And Ben, in about the 20 seconds we have left with you, what are you hearing from sheriffs and mayors in the communities along the border?
You know, it just kind of varies. Some people think this is something that absolutely should happen. We've also got some mayors who say, look, having National Guard roaming our streets makes people feel uncomfortable and the border is safe.
That's Ben Philpott. He covers state politics and policy at KUT in Austin, Texas. Ben, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, now to Detroit, where the city's public sector retirees have voted to accept cuts to their pension benefits and cost of living increases. The results come after months of court-required voting as part of a sweeping plan to help the city emerge from bankruptcy. Detroit is struggling on many fronts, though. Perhaps its biggest challenge is stabilizing its population. Fewer than 700,000 people now live in the Motor City. That is down from 1.8 million in the middle of the 20th century. Whether to stay or leave Detroit is something that Michigan radio reporter Sarah Hewlett and her family have been grappling with. And right up there on the list of considerations is crime.
There are signs that Detroit is improving things on the crime front. Violent crime is down. 911 response times are getting better. But Detroit's still a dangerous place to live, even compared to other big cities.
My name is Kathy Marshall, and we are in North Rosedale Park, Detroit.
For 19 years, Marshall lived in a great big 1930s Tudor on a grand old boulevard. Every morning, she got up to meet a friend at 5:15, and they'd walk their dogs. That's what they were doing in December when a car pulled up next to them.
A guy jumped out with a very large shotgun, and he pointed it right in between my eyes, just a few inches from my face, and threatened to kill me if I didn't give him my money.
"We don't have any money," Marshall told him. "We're out walking our dogs." That just seemed to make him mad. He started waving the gun around.
And he was threatening to kill the dogs, and he's threatening to kill us. And, you know, it was completely terrifying.
Marshall says she'd never even thought about leaving the city before. She raised her three kids in Detroit, volunteered at just about every community function, coached soccer. But after the ordeal ended, another car pulled up and the guys took off. Marshall walked home and hugged her husband.
And I just said, get me out of here. Get me out of Detroit right now.
Marshall put her house on the market that month and moved out of the city on February 1st. So here we are, a few months later.
I want the big sprinkler.
That holdup happened right around the corner from where I live with my husband and our two little girls.
My name is Evelyn. My sister's name is Jane.
Just like Kathy Marshall, we love our neighborhood, and we love living in Detroit. We love the energy and the people, but we are struggling with whether to stay. When it comes to crime, there are two kinds of conversations Detroiters tend to have. There are the ones we have with people who don't understand why anyone would live in Detroit. In those conversations, I probably won't talk about our car that got stolen or the rock that got thrown through our dining room window. And then there are the conversations we have at our kitchen tables with our neighbors and families. In my case, with my husband, Brian.
What's the first thing that goes through your mind when something bad happens, when crime happens close to us?
That I'm crazy for living here with my family. And I wonder, what am I doing? I need to do something about it. I need to move before something happens. Because if I don't, and something happens, I don't know how I could live with that.
Right.
When you live in a city, you accept that there will be crime. Whether you feel safe depends a lot on whether you've been robbed or assaulted, or you know someone who has. People stay in Detroit for a lot of reasons. Some people can't leave. Others might feel like we do. We want our girls to grow up with a sense of responsibility to their community. But violent crime has visited our neighborhood with alarming frequency lately. And with every frightening story we hear, it gets harder for us to stay. For Here and Now, I'm Sarah Hewlett in Detroit.